12, verses 13 through 17. Mark 12, verses 13 through 17. Last time we had the parable of the tenants, and now remembering that this is the week before Jesus is to be crucified, and Jesus knew that that was going to happen, we have this question brought to Jesus in Mark 12, verses 13 through 17, page 1008 in your pew Bible. And they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk. And they came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true and do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not?" But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, "Why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." And they brought one, and he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." Jesus said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they marveled at him. May God bless to us the reading of this, his word, as we meditate upon it, and as we think about Caesar and God. Again, we are in the last week of Jesus' earthly ministry, before his crucifixion and his resurrection. We've had the parable of the tenants spoken against the leaders of the people. They're not happy about it. They realize the parable of the tenants has been preached by Jesus against them. And so we need to think a little bit about who the them is and who the they are. And for review, if you look in chapter 11, the them and the they that is referred to in what we have just read is found in verse 27. "And they," that is the disciples, "came again to Jerusalem with Jesus. And as he was walking in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him, and they said to him, 'By what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do them?'" And then we have the account of the issue of authority and who gave the authority to John the Baptist and so forth. And then in chapter 12, verse 1, he began to speak to them in parables. There it is, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. And we had last week a wonderful meditation by Reverend Leach on the parable of the tenants. Verse 12, "And they," the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes, "were seeking to arrest him, but feared the people, for they perceived that he had told the parable against them. So they left him and went away." And then we start our reading. "And they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk." So we have the leaders of the people based in the temple, the chief priests, the elders, the scribes. These are people who are leaders in Jerusalem. They are running things as far as they are concerned. They are cooperating with those who are above them. They send, however, people who are near to them, but not quite. Pharisees and Herodians. Pharisees and Herodians. Pharisees are unhappy with what's going on in the temple because, you see, the Romans are in charge, and the Pharisees don't like the Romans being in charge, feeling that they have a big fortress looking out over the temple, and at times send in guards and other folks to settle riots and settle disputes. And this is not quite kosher. Pharisees are not necessarily the people who are the chief priests. The chief priests are probably Sadducees, and the Sadducees are cooperating with the Romans. The Pharisees are sort of in between. There's going to be other people that are very unhappy about the Romans. They're called the Zealots. They are zealous to see the Romans out of Israel. It's interesting. when Jesus lists his disciples, Matthew lists the disciples. We have Matthew, the tax collector. He's collecting taxes for the Romans. And we also have Simon the Zealot, who left his world of zealotry to follow Jesus. We don't hear much about Simon the Zealot. We hear much more about Matthew, the tax collector. But Simon the Zealot is a person who had been part of a group that despised the Romans and wanted the Romans out and was willing to get involved. The Zealots were willing to get involved in guerrilla warfare eventually against the Romans, which will lead to disaster for the nation of Israel in AD 66 to 70, about 40 years after this period of time. The Herodians, who are they? We're not exactly sure who the Herodians are. They're probably people willing to support the Romans. Herodians are followers of Herod. Herod was cooperating with the Romans, and so the Herodians are probably pro-Roman as well. But we don't know exactly who they are. Note the purpose. They are sent to trap Jesus in his talk, in what he says. And therefore, they are trying desperately to find something to bring charges against Jesus and trap the Son of God incarnate in his talk. Notice they don't come in person. They came in person and they listened to Jesus in person. He told them the parable of the tenants against them. And now they send a proxy, the Pharisees and the Herodians, whom they also know don't like Jesus. Jesus had tangles with the Pharisees in earlier times, and the Herodians are mentioned only in Mark and Matthew, and also at times he has tensions with them. The Herodians, the question would be, can you trap the Son of God incarnate in his talk? How arrogant to even think that we could. We and the chief priests and the scribes and the elders are no match for Jesus. In chapter 12, verse 15, knowing their hypocrisy, Jesus knows our hypocrisy. He knows our hearts. He knows what we're thinking. He knows the motives. And while these people are not going to say their motives outright, they are there to trap him in his talk. And Jesus knows what they're about and what they're doing. In Matthew 22, verses 15 through 22, we have the same account. We don't have to turn to it right now, but there are a few little added details. One of the things that Matthew says is, knowing their hypocrisy and aware of their malice, of their evil thoughts, knowing that indeed they had a sinful motivation for going to Jesus, as we will see. Jesus is aware of their malice, knowing their hypocrisy. Hypocrite. Somebody pointed out to me 20 years ago that only Jesus calls people hypocrites because only Jesus knows their hearts. We can talk about hypocrisy, but to their face, only Jesus says, you are a hypocrite. I cannot say any of you are hypocrites because I don't know your hearts. I can only know what I see of you on the outside. But Jesus knows our hearts. A hypocrite comes from the word hypokritos, coming from the Greek theater world of actor. He is a good actor. And so knowing their good acting and knowing their evil thoughts, Jesus was aware of who they are. They were acting, they were pretending to show respect to Jesus. Today we're going to use a baseball metaphor. I'm not a baseball fan, but as I meditated on this, I thought, well, in some sense, as baseball season finally, I think, is beginning or something like that.
It started,
okay. We have here, first of all, two pitches, a straight fastball from these Pharisees and Herodians, a curveball, and Jesus hits a home run in response. So a straight fastball, a curveball, and a home run, indeed, a grand slam in response. First of all, the straight ball. As you read this account, we see from this sinful interaction of sinful motivation, four truths about Jesus, that sinful, malicious, unbelieving hypocrites realize. Jesus is, and the four aspects of Jesus are listed right there very plainly. Jesus is true. Jesus does not care about anyone's opinion. Jesus is not swayed by appearances. Jesus truly teaches the way of God. Would that unbelievers said that about us if we practice that consistently? We're true. We do not care about other people's opinions. We're not swayed by the crowd. We're not swayed by the beautiful people of this world and what the movie actors and the actresses and people of wealth and so forth say. We truly teach the way of God. Would that believers said that about us? But Jesus knows their hypocrisy, and even though as you list these wonderful aspects of who Jesus is, something is hollow about these truths. These are straight pitches. These are truths about Jesus, and yet we also know that there's something behind all of this, and that's going to come in the curveball they're about to throw. One interesting thing is that in Matthew 22, the true and the truly teaching the way of God are combined. So in our passage in Mark, it is he is true, he is not does not care about anyone's opinion, he is not swayed by appearances, he truly teaches the way of God. You have the true and truly sort of serving as sandwiches or bookends for what is in between, not caring about anyone's opinion and not being swayed by appearances. In Matthew, it is Jesus is true and truly teaches the way of God. Whatever was said, and it was said in various orders, perhaps several people asked him the same sort of thing around the same time, we have this portrait of Jesus that the unbelieving world saw. And then they try to throw a curveball at him. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Let's think a little bit about that question. Is it lawful? Whose law? By what standard are you going to say it's lawful? Certainly, according to the Roman world, it is lawful to pay taxes to Caesar. They had ways of dealing with you if you didn't pay taxes to Caesar, and they were not pleasant ways if you broke the law of the Romans. However, the Pharisees are not worried very much about the laws of the Romans. They're worried about the law of God. There are two aspects of the law of God that the Pharisees had. First of all, there is the written law, the Torah, which we find, we share, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That's the law of the prophets and the writings Jesus spoke about. And you have, therefore, is it lawful according to the Torah to obey Caesar and pay taxes? Remember also that the Pharisees had another law, which is the oral law. We're not going to get too involved in that today, but that's what's written down ultimately in the Talmud. It's the Pharisaical law, and it is the law derived from the Torah as the diaspora, the scattering of the Jewish people throughout the ancient world emerged. And Jewish people then said, well, how can we obey the Torah when we're no longer living in Israel, and we're living in Babylon, we're living in Tarsus, we're living in Rome, we're living in Egypt, we're living all over the ancient world. And so over a 500-year period before Jesus, they used Greek philosophy and Greek methodical thinking to lay out laws. What is a Sabbath day's journey? How can we obey the law of God when we live in today in a modern world? You can go down, for instance, to a Jewish hospital in New York, Mount Sinai, and you'll have the Sabbath elevator, which is you don't press any buttons on that elevator on Friday evening, certainly all the way to Saturday night. It stops at every floor because you see in Talmud law, if you reach out and you press a button on the elevator, you are causing a spark, which is lighting a fire, which therefore means that you are violating one of the Talmudic laws about lighting a fire. And indeed, in the Torah, it says you should not light a fire on the Sabbath. And so they don't want to do that, therefore it is prohibited, but they want to go visit their friend who's sick in the hospital, a laudable thing. And so developed this method by which they could go up to the 50th floor, whatever it is, of the hospital by not lighting a spark and causing a spark to light a fire. It's that kind of thinking that inhabits the Pharisaical mind in a big way in Jesus' time. And the Pharisees added on a lot of these extra laws not found in the Bible to the people, and Jesus condemns that. He says you're placing burdens upon people that were not found in the original Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, especially Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It is a huge debate going on in Jesus' time about paying taxes to Caesar. Remember that you have a whole bunch of oppressors. We've had the Assyrians come in 720 BC, 722 BC, and conquer the northern kingdom. We've had the Babylonians come in 586 BC and conquer the southern kingdom. The Persians allow the Jews to return, but they run things for 200 years. And then the Greeks take over, and they conquer the Persians. There's a time of Jewish independence for about 100 years under the Maccabees, and then the Romans come in, and now the Romans are in charge. The Romans set up a tax system, which to some degree later on the Roman tax system is inherited in the Christian church to this day. You hear the term parish and diocese. That is not coming from the Bible. That's coming from the old Roman tax system, whereby a later Roman emperor divided up the Roman Empire into dioceses, which was regions, and then broke up each diocese into a parochia. Economics is related there, occhia economics, a parochia, an economic unit, and that became the taxation unit for the Roman tax system. In Jesus' time, what they did was they counted people. They took a census. And so the tax that is being referred to here is the census tax. You can get a sense of it in the Christmas story that we read in Luke 2. In those days, Quirinius was governor, a census was taken, and all the world went to their city of origin, their family city, in order to be enrolled to be taxed, Luke 2. And so Mary and Joseph have to get on a donkey. We don't know if Mary walked or if Mary was on the donkey. It was not a comfortable ride for a pregnant woman expecting the Son of God. And they have to go about 60 miles from Nazareth down to Bethlehem to get enrolled in the census, the Roman census required by the Roman governor in the time of Caesar Augustus, because all the world was to be taxed. And so this is a burden in which people had to travel, they would be counted, and then they would either pay their tax at that time or they would be on the records of the Romans. They didn't have IBM computers in those days to try to help keep track of folks, or Google or whatever it is, but you were enrolled and then you were taxed according to this Roman system. And there is a spectrum, as I explained, in the Jewish world. The zealots are on the left side, so to speak. They say, no, do not pay. Do not cooperate with the Romans. And so the zealots refused to pay taxes as much as they could. Chief priests, scribes, and elders, these were the ones questioning Jesus, at least sending Pharisees to question Jesus, they say, yes, pay the tax to Caesar, cooperate, otherwise there will be disaster for the nation of Israel. The Romans will come and they will smash us to smithereens and take away our nation. They were right. In AD 70, the nation was taken away as the zealots started a riot in 66 AD that led to a war. The Romans were at their most powerful at that time. They crushed the nation of Israel and they expelled the people of Israel from Israel. They finished off the job 60 years later under what's known as the Bar Kokhba Revolt in 132 AD, and there was no more Jewish state under the Roman Empire. Palestine became a Roman province, and the Jewish people were pushed out of that and scattered throughout the entire ancient world. Now, the Pharisees are sort of caught in between. If we don't, we will lose power and we will be wiped out. They're right. But there were some Pharisees that said, we have to pay this tax with a picture of Caesar on the front, a denarius, And on that back of that, there are references to Caesar being Lord, Caesar is God. And we refuse, therefore, to recognize that. And besides which, if Caesar is God, that means we have an idol in our hands. We will not even pick up and touch a denarius because that is an idol. And it has a picture of a Roman god on the front. His name is Caesar. We refuse to recognize that Roman god. And that's going to be a major issue for the Christian church in the next 200 years. Is Jesus Lord or is Caesar Lord? The Jewish people, they're debating the same thing in the first century in Jesus' time. If we use Roman money and touch it, that means we are involved in idolatry. We are violating God's law. And so these folks knew that if Jesus sided with the zealots, he would be labeled a rebel against Rome, and he would be in big trouble. If Jesus sided with the Sadducees, then he was a traitor to Israel. Maybe the zealots would bump him off. And therefore, they thought, we have him. We've got him in a dilemma he cannot solve. Jesus sighs. Knowing their hypocrisy, he says to them, why put me to the test? And in here, in asking that question, he is dropping a huge hint that he is God and that they should not be doing this. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 16, we have a command from the law of God, Deuteronomy 6:16. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. We sang about that in Psalm 95. Do not put the Lord your God to the test. And we sang it in Psalm 95. In Matthew 4, verse 7, parallel in Luke chapter 4, we have Jesus saying to Satan, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And I shall not test the Lord your God. And so Jesus quotes that command from Deuteronomy 6:16. And here he's hinting, do not put me to the test. I am the Son of God incarnate. But he does move on, and notice what they call him. They call him teacher or master. They don't really call him rabbi. They say he's a good teacher. They don't call him Lord. They don't say Jesus. They call him teacher, master. We know that you are, and then all those good things that we talked about earlier. Jesus responds, bring me a denarius. In Matthew 22:9, it is, bring me the coin for the tax. What is a denarius? A denarius is a silver Roman coin. It's about the size of a dime. It's not very big. It was about a day's wages in the world of Jesus. And so you're talking about a day's pay, which would be the Roman tax. And the question was, should people from Israel pay that tax? Note that Jesus does not have a denarius. He doesn't say, oh, I have a denarius in my pocket. Here, take a look at it. He says, bring me a denarius. And they managed to produce a denarius, probably produced by the Sadducees. The Pharisees would not touch it because of the idolatry issue. And then he asks the question, whose icon or epigraph is on it? Icon. We use that term in church and in the Christian church, icons of statues or especially pictures or representations of Mary, Jesus, the saints. Whose icon and whose writing, epigraph, is on it? This is a reminder to all the Romans and to all people that the Romans thought Caesar is Lord and Caesar is God. And it is a publicity stunt on the part of the Romans. It's a publicity stunt that all nations use. You can go to Canada and you find there is Canadian coins with the picture of the Queen on the coin. Think a little bit about our American money. Who's on the coin of the penny? Abraham Lincoln. Go look at a nickel. Thomas Jefferson on the back is his monument. On the dime is Franklin Roosevelt. We've gotten used to that. That probably was a big controversy back in those days when that was inaugurated because, you know, FDR was not always loved by everybody. Go forward to the quarter. We have Washington, George Washington. And then we have, for the 50-cent piece, I believe it's Benjamin Franklin. on. And so we have various ways whereby we remember people of significance in the American world. In the dollar, we don't usually use coin dollars, but they do exist. There's the Susan B. Anthony dollar. And so we moved away from presidents and moved on into changing ideas of who's important in the 1970s, the 1980s, and so forth. So you can look at American money, and you can actually see quite a bit of what's important, at least to people in charge, in 1850, 1900, 1950, the year 2000, and so forth. Render to Caesar. Pay or give an offering. We don't sing it in our congregation now. I wish we did, but the new Psalter changed things around a bit. But there are some of you in this room who remember the years before 2009 when we didn't have the blue Psalter. We had the red Psalter. And the red Psalter had what we sang when the offering was taken up. What shall I render to the Lord? What shall my offering be for all the gracious benefits he hath bestowed on me? I'll lift salvation's cup, O Lord, and on the Lord will call. I'll pay my vows now to the Lord before his people all. And render is not a word that we often use these days in the year 2020, but it means to give over, to pay, to fulfill your vow, to fulfill your duty. And so Jesus says two things: render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and to God that which is God's. Jesus seems to side with the Sadducees and seems to be ruling against the strict Pharisees who don't want to touch the coin to pay the tax, and the zealots. But remember, it will be the Roman state that he seems to be supporting. It will be the Roman state that will execute him in 4 or 5 days under Pontius Pilate. And he predicted that. And as you read that account, it'd be instructive to review what happens when Pontius Pilate interviews Jesus. We don't have time to go into that. But we have the Roman state executing, ultimately, Jesus. And that is repeated in the Apostles' Creed. Suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. We read Paul in Romans 12 through 13. Jesus was not a Roman citizen, and therefore his mode of execution is crucifixion. A dreadful way to go. Peter also is crucified, as far as we know, by church tradition, crucified upside down, so he wouldn't be crucified like Jesus right side up. Paul, on the other hand, is a Roman citizen. Paul writes to the Roman church, obey the emperor as much as you can, give respect, honor Caesar when you can, as long as it does not involve disobeying God. Paul will also be executed by the nation, the empire of which he is a part. Paul was a Roman citizen. Paul has a nicer death than Jesus. He gets his head chopped off. And now you may wonder, you know, given a choice, if you're sitting in a cell, which would you prefer? I would recommend beheading. It's not a pleasant thought, but I recommend it rather than crucifixion. Crucifixion is a dreadful way to go. Beheading is quick, you will go and be with the Lord quickly. Paul was executed. Why? Because he's a Roman citizen. That gets continued on, by the way, in the European aristocratic tradition. If you are a duke or a lord or whatever who has fallen out with the king, you get your head chopped off, as Thomas More did under Henry VIII. But if you're a peasant, if you're a nobody in England or in France or whatever, you have a much more dreadful execution, a much more terrible death. We'll get into that another time, but that tradition continues. Interesting that both tell us to obey the state that is in charge, but both are going to be executed by that state. What is Jesus doing when he says, render to Caesar that which is Caesar, and render to God that which is God? He is contrasting God and Caesar, and reminding us, his opponents, and us, that God rules over Caesar, and that he rules over Caesar. What belongs to Caesar and the state? Well, tax revenue for this temporary world. Submission, as long as it does not involve disobeying God and his law. Jesus doesn't get into that in too much detail. He just simply says, render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, render to God that which is God's. He doesn't say what is Caesar's, what is God's necessarily. But he just simply says, do this, and this is my ruling. What belongs to God? Well, what shall I render to the Lord? I'll lift salvation's cup, we sing in Psalm 116. Repentance, obedience, service and gratitude to God, offerings and gratitude to God. We are to be living sacrifices before God. What we render to God is far more important than what we render to Caesar. But rendering to God includes rendering to Caesar as best we can, as long as it does not involve disobeying God. God will always hit a home run against us. Indeed, he will always hit a grand slam and a perfect game against us. So we have some application that comes out of this account of sin and sinful hearts coming to Jesus and asking a question to catch. And we get great blessing. And so I have 7 applications for you. Perfect biblical number. First of all, don't try to outwit Jesus or trap him in his words. You can't. God knows our hearts, he knows our minds, he knows our souls, he knows our bodies. Psalm 139 talks about how God enfolds us and wraps around us and knows the words that we're about to say. God knows us, he is beyond us, he is infinite, we are finite. We cannot in any way outwit Jesus or trap Jesus in his words. Application 2. Pray that Christ is reflected in us to a watching world. These people realized that Jesus really was the real deal. He was truthful. He was not swayed by opinion. He was not listening to the beautiful people of the ancient world. He wasn't worried about appearances and exterior appearances. They realized that Jesus was the real deal, but they refused to obey him or bow down to him. We should pray that those wonderful things reflected in the life of Christ are reflected in our lives. To be truthful, to not worry about what the rest of the world thinks, and not to be affected by exterior appearances that may hide terrible sin underneath. Application number three. Don't put God to a test. If you think he can fail the test, he won't. Don't put him to the test. 4, pay your taxes and render your offerings to the Lord. So that's just something that we need to do. A lot of people whine and complain about paying taxes and so forth. But God says, pay your taxes and render your offerings to the Lord as we bring our tithes and our offerings. I like that phrase, God's tithes and our offerings to the Lord. 5, obey your government as long as you are not disobeying God. Obey your government as long as you are not disobeying God. And all throughout the New Testament church talks about this because they have a very strong government at that time, the Roman government. And they are set in a situation of great stability, but that stability is going to collapse in the next 400 years, and as we will see. 6, keep church and state separate. Now, when I say keep church and state separate, that doesn't mean that state does not have an obligation to God, but keep church and state separate. The Christian church has often struggled with that. We talk about that in the American world a lot, about, oh, we have separation of church and state. We actually don't. That is not a phrase found in the United States Constitution. We have a Congress that is not supposed to make an establishment of religion, which Reformed Presbyterians have argued with. When that Constitution was founded, there was a specific religion in many of the states, but not every single state, and that's a matter for discussion for another time. In the queries for ordination, installation, and licensure, and this, by the way, is not reflected in the Reformed Presbyterian testimony, as far as I can see. But in 5, we have this question about the teaching of Scripture about church and state. Do you believe it to be the teaching of Scripture that church and state are distinct and separate institutions, that both are under the mediatorial rule of the Lord Jesus Christ? And then it talks about the form of government being Presbyterian. So this whole vow is focused upon government and so forth, church and state. They are separate institutions, but both are to acknowledge the sovereignty of Christ. So keep church and state separate, but remember, and this is application number 6, remember that the state belongs to God and to Christ. His kingdom and his kingship is stronger than any nation on earth. The Romans discovered that in the next 400 years, there is no more Roman Empire. It's gone. Caesar is no longer in charge. Other Caesars have come and gone. The kingdom of Christ continues. The kingdom of Christ is being built. It may not feel like Christ is in charge, but he is in charge, and he's in charge of the coronavirus right now. He is in building his church. He is establishing his kingdom. Every nation, including the United States, has an obligation to bow to him, and every nation has to remember that it could be swept away by his wrath and his judgment. 500 years from now, who knows what will be here? We cannot just simply assume there will always be the nations as we have known them in the last 100 years. And World War I reminded us of that, and certainly World War II reminded us of that as well. And the nations will fade, but his kingdom will last for eternity. And finally, that actually is the final. Remember that Christ's kingdom is eternal. Remember that the state belongs to God. Remember that the state is not the be-all and end-all of existence, even if the USSR and Nazi Germany and lots of other states in the last 100 years have said the state is the ultimate arbiter. Remember that ultimately it is Christ's kingdom that will be for eternity, not the American world, not the world as we know it, only the kingdom of Christ. Let's pray. Lord, thank you. Thank you that you are building your kingdom, that you rule above all earthly thrones, as Psalm 22 says. Help us to remember that.